All right, guys, well, good to see everyone here tonight. Glad you guys turned out. There's a very special speaker today. He's the managing editor at Reason Magazine. He's also the author of Rebels on Air, an alternative history of radio in America. And he's going to be giving a talk tonight about the paranoid Senate. Among other questions he's going to answer is this really a time of unusually fierce fear and violent rhetoric? Is political paranoia just a fringe phenomenon, or is it also found in the middle of the road? And also, what does a conspiracy have in common with a can of Four Loko? From James Wenninger von Braun, the neo-Nazi who opened fire at the Holocaust Memorial Museum, to Jared Lee Loughran, the conscious dreaming enthusiast, you've heard ample warnings about extreme paranoia since Barack Obama became president. You've heard much less about the paranoia of the political center. This is cut off. When the mainstream media treats unconnected crimes as a grand beloved movement, they unwittingly echo the very conspiracy theories that we pronounce. Both brands of connected dots, fantasy, are really devoid of any order actually emerging in the world. And our speaker here today, Jesse Walker, is going to be more complete account of both paranoia in the United States. Your conspiracy is not really a phenomenon of which you will argue. Rather, the American center, who you established, is rarely recognized as a conspiracy. So with that, I'd like to welcome Jesse Walker.
One little apology before I start. I've been writing about this stuff for a few years now. This is the first time I've delivered it in lecture form, so I will be attached to my notes a little bit more than what would be ideal. Hopefully that won't affect me too much. So on January 8th, this guy, our cover guy on the current issue of Reason, Jared Lee Loughran, opened fire in a Tucson parking lot. He killed 6 people, wounded 13 others, including Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. I stayed glued to the news that day, and in 2011, being glued to the news entails being glued to your Twitter and Facebook feeds. So I saw a wave of comments declaring that Loughran was clearly inspired by talk radio, by violent political imagery, by right-wing conspiracy theories, and even by a map that Sarah Palin's PAC had released during the 2010 elections, which had illustrated the congressional districts that the PAC was targeting with little crosshairs icons. One of the icons was superimposed over Giffords' district, and this apparently was supposed to be evidence that the map had inspired the shooting. Now, I'm tempted to spend a long time quoting the various things that liberal friends of mine wrote on Facebook, but I'll stick to some statements from fairly well-known figures and venues. Marcos Melitzos of the Daily Coast tweeted, quote, "Mission accomplished, Sarah Palin." Michael Daly of the New York Daily News wrote that, "Now that Palin may have the blood of more than some poor caribou on her hands, I wonder if she will continue putting people in crosshairs and calling on folks to reload." He also said, quote, "Anyone with any sense at all knows that violent language can incite actual violence, that metaphor can incite murder. At the very least, Palin added to a climate of violence." And there was an article in The Guardian over in the UK that strained very hard to find traces of the Tea Parties and Loughran's infamously weird YouTube videos. My favorite line in that article was, "The US Constitution, the Bible of the Tea Parties, features heavily." Now, along with comments of that nature, there was another sort of response, one that was a little more careful in its accusations, but ultimately even weirder. And I call these the "we have no evidence that political rhetoric has anything to do with this crime, but this crime proves that we need to pay more attention to our political rhetoric" articles. And these appeared in a lot of mainstream outlets, but the perfect specimen was on Alternet, a story that Adele Stan wrote that began with the line, "It's too soon to say what exactly motivated the man apprehended for the shooting of Representative Gabrielle Giffords and 18 others outside of Tucson supermarket on Saturday." So that's sensible, starting with a very clear statement of, we don't know what's going on in this guy's head. A few lines later it says, "So to those who would like to attribute Loughran's actions to the Tea Party, I say, hold up, take a breath. But to those on the far right, and to the more mainstream right-wingers who fail to condemn the poisonous claims of the far right, I say, you're hardly off the hook. had the vitriolic rhetoric that today shapes Arizona's political landscape, and indeed our national landscape, never come to call. Lochner's may have found a different reason to go on a killing spree, but that vitriol does exist as a powerful prompt to the paranoid. And those who publicly deem war on the federal government a patriot's duty should today be doing some soul searching. So then you start to see the pivot. In the subtitle to the article, that statement gets compressed to, it's too soon to say what motivated the man apprehended for the shooting, but the Tea Party culture of political intimidation affirmed his violent resource, his violent impulses. And then the headline of the article was, how the right's rhetoric fueled the actions of Arizona's mass murder. So you can see how this moves from inside the article to from a somewhat tenuous connection to something that in the headline of the article simply states that A led to B. Now, when one outlet publishes a story like that, my reaction is to think less of that outlet, or perhaps of the person who wrote the story. But when a lot of outlets run a story like that, it's clear that more than just individual error is at work here. People are taking it as a given that we're seeing a wave of political violence, and that the violent and paranoid rhetoric that people associate with Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck and others is at least partly to blame for it. So when an act of political violence happens, their first instinct is to plug that act into that narrative. And if it isn't clear that it fits the narrative, well, while we wait for the evidence to roll in, the rhetoric is to blame, we might as well get a jump on thinking about the evils of that rhetoric. Now, I'm going to say a bit more about that narrative in a bit, but before I go any further in that direction, I'm going to talk a little bit about Four Loko. I'm sure that most of you remember the Four Loko panic, and this does connect. It's not like a commercial being inserted in the middle of the talk. I'm sure most of you remember the Four Loko panic from last year, but a quick review to bring everyone up to speed. Four Loko, drink that mixed alcohol and caffeine. One can had less alcohol than a bottle of wine, and about as much caffeine as a cup of coffee. And last November, the FDA banned it. The argument against it was that the mix of drugs led to a state of wide-awake drunk, with the caffeine masking the alcohol effect so that drinkers don't realize how impaired they are. And it would be interesting, I think, to survey all the reporters and legislators and regulators who bought this argument to find out how many of them have enjoyed an Irish coffee or a Jack and Coke or any other drink that mixes alcohol and caffeine. At any rate, my colleague Jacob Sullum covered the Four Loko panic pretty closely. I'm going to read to you a little bit from one of his articles. Over and over again, fear-mongering officials and hyperbolic reporters cited two incidents, one at Ramoco College in New Jersey, the other at Central Washington University, in which students who drank Four Loko were taken to the hospital. These 15 students, most of whom seem to have been drinking other alcoholic beverages in addition to Four Loko, represent something like 0.015% of the 100,000 or so 18 to 20-year-olds who make alcohol-related visits to American emergency rooms each year. Yet their drunken stupidity was repeatedly presented as evidence of Four Loko's unique dangers. Likewise, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration counted 13,800 alcohol-related fatalities in 2008. It did not put crashes involving Four Loko drinkers in a special category, but news organizations around the country, primed to perceive the drink as unusually hazardous, routinely do. 3 days before the Food and Drug Administration declared Four Loko illegal, a 14-year-old stole his parents' SUV and crashed it into a guardrail in Denton, Texas, killing his girlfriend. Here is how the local Fox station headlined its story, Four Loko Found in Deadly Teen Crash. That's the end of the quote. I read that Fox story, by the way. I followed Jacob's link to it. And the police didn't just find 5 cans of Four Loko. They also found a 12-pack of beer. But Fox did not headline the story, Beer Found in Deadly Teen Crash. And they certainly didn't call it Drunk 14-Year-Old Does Something Dangerous, which is actually a pretty more accurate statement of the chain of causation. So if you read the current coverage of political violence, Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin and others like them play the Four Loko role. No matter what else is going on in the driver's head, reporters are primed to look for Glenn Beck in the back seat of the SUV. The main difference is that the kid in the SUV really did have Four Loko in the vehicle, Beck and Palin. And I'm not a Glenn Beck fan, I'm not a Sarah Palin fan, I'm not saying this as a partisan defender. But Beck and Palin get invoked whether or not they had anything to do with what happened. Most of these crimes, when you look at them closely, you find that they don't even fit that much of the narrative. So let's get back to the political narrative. and look at it in closer detail. It's been coalescing since the last months of the 2008 presidential campaign, but I think it took its essential shape on June 10, 2009. That's when James Winokur von Brunn, the 88-year-old neo-Nazi, entered the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. and opened fire, killing a security guard. This came 10 days after the murder of the abortion doctor George Tiller in Kansas, and the two crimes were linked in a sort of free associative way into a pattern of rising right-wing violence. And some pundits tried to tie the two slayings to a smattering of other crimes, many dating back to the Bush administration, which were linked only by the fact that the criminals all hailed from one corner or another of the paranoid right. The biggest stretch I saw was the liberal blogger Sarah Robinson, who does a lot of writing about activities on the far right. She had a list that included a guy who had stalked his girlfriend for 2 years and had just killed her. 2 years, like going back 2 years before 2009. And if you're wondering how this had to do with the climate of violence under Obama, apparently in addition to being a stalker and murderer and crazy person, he was an anti-Semite. Therefore, it could be put into the right-wing violence category. So anyway, having established this crime wave to their satisfaction, the analysts move on to denounce the unindicted instigators. Bonnie Irby of U.S. News and World Report wrote that the Musin guard's death was to be blamed on promoters of hate. She said that the shooting was, quote, a clarion call for banning hate speech. And the New York Times columnist Bob Herbert wrote that he can't help feeling that the crimes were, quote, just the beginning and that worse is to come, and that this was in part thanks to, quote, the over-the-top rhetoric of the National Rifle Association. His Times colleague Paul Krugman warned that right-wing extremism is being systematically fed by the conservative media and political establishment. This is Paul Krugman, who today blogged that he doesn't read the conservative media, so I guess he was going by what he had seen quoted. Also in the Times, Frank Rich announced that, this is again a quote, homicide-saturated vituperation is endemic among many Limbaughs. After the museum murder, Rich wrote, the talk show host Glenn Beck, beginning of quote, rushed onto Fox News to describe the Obama-hating killer as a lone gunman nut job. Yet in the same show, Beck also said von Brunn was a symptom that the pot in America is boiling, as if Beck himself were not the boiling pot cheering the kettle on. I'm not going to try to disentangle that vastly mixed metaphor for you, but I will say that when critics blame the anti-abortion movement for the death of George Tiller, there at least was a coherent connection between the movement's anti-abortion rhetoric and the assassin's target. Now, say what you will about Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh, they're not known for attacking the Holocaust Museum. This is not sort of in the list of targets for people in right-wing TV and radio, although it is on the list of targets, presumably, of aging neo-Nazis. So I've been following these cases as closely as I can whenever they come on the news, and it's actually very rare for you to see any credible chain of influence between the criminal and the people being blamed for inspiring them. It does happen sometimes. There's the Tiller case, the abortion doctor who was killed. There's Byron Williams, who got into a shootout with cops. I think he wounded two of them while he was on his way to kill some of the grant makers at the Tides Foundation. He was influenced in part by Glenn Beck's conspiracy theories about Tides, although he also seems to have gotten fixated on Tides before he learned that Beck was also fixated on Tides. There's also a lot of the death threats that were made during the debate over healthcare reform, and Seth, I'm going to talk a bit more about death threats a little later. But more often you get someone like Jared Loughner, who doesn't come from the far right, who doesn't come from the far left, he comes from the far end of the political long tail. And if you look at the statements, it's this sort of odd mishmash of complaints that you might associate with the left, with the right, in Loughner's case, what I would just call New Age paranoia, often painfully specific items from the killer or would-be killer's own life. The most telling case might be, as far as the way the narrative is constructed, might be when the Kentucky census worker named Bill Sparkman was found bound and lifeless with the word fed on his chest. This was in September 2009, and when that story broke, Rick Ungar at True Slant wrote, send the body to Glenn Beck, and he wondered whether, quote, the time has come for the FCC to consider exactly what constitutes screaming fire over the publicly owned airwaves. Other writers pointed their fingers at Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, who had been attacking the census around that time. And I first heard the story because a pretty well-known liberal writer emailed me. We had been debating these issues in a friendly way. And he sent me a link to the story with one sentence: "I think you just lost the debate." Over at The Atlantic, Andrew Sullivan wrote that, quote, "The one thing we know for certain," unquote, "is that the death was not a suicide." And 2 months later, investigators ruled that it was a suicide. He wanted to kill himself and make it look like a murder so that his son could collect on insurance. It was sort of a matter of scandal on those lines. It hadn't been a political crime at all. So let me stress something. My thesis doesn't actually rest on whether this death was a murder any more than the question of whether there's a rising tide of right-wing violence rests on whether it was a murder. There is a certain number of politically motivated crimes each year. My position isn't affected by one single death, is or isn't one of them. A bunch of deaths, yes, but not one. What's important was the leap to judgment. A large number of commentators assumed inaccurately that the death was a murder, that the murder was political, and that the motive was linked to rhetoric that they disapproved of. It's the same thing you saw at the Holocaust Museum, the same thing you saw with Loeffner, same thing that has happened again and again. They made those assumptions because it fit a narrative that they're committed to. When people on the far left or the far right do that, they're accused of paranoia, of being so eager to connect the dots that they run ahead of what the evidence actually says. But when mainstream commentators treat this small group of unconnected crimes as a grand malevolent movement, they wind up unwittingly echoing the very conspiracy theories they denounce. You've heard a lot about paranoid extremists. This is the paranoia of the center. And the paranoid center becomes even more visible when people start moving beyond anecdotes and trying to make a database claim for the narrative. That generally comes in two forms. The first is death threat data. And there's three claims that you'll hear it here. One claims that there's been a 400% increase in the number of threats against President Obama compared to President Bush. Second is that there's been a 21.5% increase in threats against IRS agents, very precise. And the third is a 300% increase in threats against members of Congress. And I'll just run through those one by one because, again, this is actually data that's very hard to get your hands on because people like the Secret Service keep these numbers close to the vest, or the equivalent of the Secret Service, the guards, you know, the congressmen, and so on. They sort of feel like they don't want to give people any ideas about committing crimes, so they just try to not draw attention to death threats. The Obama number, though, is just false. It comes from Ronald Kessler's book, In the President's Secret Service, which came out in 2009. It's a book about the Secret Service. The source the claim is unsourced. It presumably comes from one of his anonymous informants within or around the Secret Service. But when I called the Secret Service to ask them about it, I spoke to their spokesman, Malcolm Wiley. He didn't want to give me the actual numbers, but he said that Kessler got his facts wrong, that when Obama was still a candidate, there was a period when he was receiving more threats than the sitting president. But that since he became president, that had leveled off, and as Wiley's exact quote to me was, the number of threats he has received has been consistent with the number received by Bush, Clinton, Reagan, and others. So that claim floated around a lot after Kessler's book came out. Then a number of people retracted it. You still see it sometimes cited in blogs and places like that, if not in the professional media, places like the Boston Globe that repeated it. So unlike threats against the president, threats against employees of the IRS really do seem to be on the rise. Last year, a number of media outlets reported that the number of threats against IRS workers had increased 21.5%, like I said, from fiscal year 2008 to fiscal year 2009, from 834 threats to 1,014. The Wall Street Journal had the big story here, and they quoted a Treasury official saying that there had been a steady upward trend in their number. But there was a problem if you wanted to blame this angry upward trend on angry rhetoric, and that's that the trend actually did not start in 2009. It started in 2006, when a Republican was in the White House, and the loudest angry rhetoric about Internal Revenue involved tax cuts, not tax increases. So in the absence of more detailed data, it isn't obvious what factors have fueled the increase, but I doubt that the chief culprit is political. I talked to one government official when I was looking to the numbers, and that person said that basically when someone decides to assault an IRS employee, it's usually a personal event that's a catalyst. And that's not to say there's never been a political cast of the threats. After a rumor began to circulate, for example, claiming that armed IRS agents would be enforcing the insurance mandate in the health care bill, there was some chest-thumping chatter online about killing any enforcers that came calling. There was like this one thread that got linked a lot on one of the Alex Jones sites with people, you know, doing their macho thing.
They were all Googling.
But the most infamous actual attack on tax workers, and that's Joe Stack, the man who flew the plane into the Austin IRS agent office February of last year, does not fit easily into a conventional political framework. He's another political long tail guy. His manifesto is a mix of left-wing resentments, right-wing resentments, and personal resentments, most notably his own tax problems, which he recounted with a wonk's attention to detail. The statement was obviously the product of one sad and angry man's own experiences. Yet Josh Marshall, a very prominent blogger, often a very good reporter, highlighted the pilot's reference to Mr. Big Brother IRS Man, and Marshall greeted the manifesto with the headline, "Ideas Have Consequences," as though no American would resent the tax man if it weren't for the GOP's anti-tax rhetoric. And then I mentioned last, threats against Congress. And let me quote a Paul Krugman column from January, a month and a half ago or so. "Last spring, Politico.com reported on a surge in threats against members of Congress," Krugman wrote, "which were already up by 300%. A number of the people making those threats had a history of mental illness, but something about the current state of America has been causing far more disturbed people than before to act out their illness by threatening or actually engaging in political violence." And then he fingers toxic rhetoric as the force making them act out. None of these people ever actually make the case that toxic rhetoric is on the increase. If you go over to Reason TV, which is Reason's video site, they put together a pretty funny mock political ad for the Thomas Jefferson, John Adams election, and there you'll find the sort of slogans and the accusations there make anything on, you know, even Alex Jones, let alone Glenn Beck, what kind of tame. So Politico did report that 300% increase. It was speaking specifically about the period of the healthcare debate. Unfortunately, what they did not reveal, and what I haven't been able to find out myself, despite calling every agency I can think of that tracks this stuff, that would have the material, but again, they don't like to release it. What they haven't revealed is how that compares to the data for debates over other hotly contested legislation in recent history. So we don't know if that was an unusually large spike in death threats, or if it's typical of what happens when a large number of people is strongly opposed to a bill that's likely to pass. I know from old press reports, for example, that there were death threats during the NAFTA debate. Was it a 300% rise? I don't know. I wish I knew. Speaking of the healthcare debate, you might remember in the summer of 2009, when the media were filled with stories about clashes, they always use the word clashes, the town hall meetings devoted to discussing healthcare reform. Usually the excitement amounted to some angry questions and heckling, but there were a few actual altercations. The press coverage often gave the impression that these were typical, and they became part of the storyline about rising violence, rising political violence. Then the reporter Mary Catherine Hamm counted the incidents and found that there had been no more than a dozen documented violent or quasi-violent episodes in the month that saw an average of more than 13 congressional town halls every day. She found that most of them involved very little physical contact, and she also found that a majority of the acts were perpetrated by the supporters of the president's reforms, not the opponents. A very slight majority, and I'm not saying this in order to say, like, no, those are the real thugs. Actually, what's striking is how very little thuggery there was on either side, that things got, you know, blown up because it makes a good story when people fight, fist fight. So I said earlier that when people start trying to make a database case for the narrative, it comes in two forms. The first form is the death threat data. The second involves quoting the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a group that sort of styles itself as a watchdog tracking the political fringe. After the Huttery were arrested in this part of the country last year, newscasters and columnists touted a Southern Poverty Law Center report claiming that the number of anti-government patriot
organizations is skyrocketing. An astonishing 363 new Patriot groups appeared in 2009, the center declared, with the totals going from 149 groups, including 42 militias, to 512, 127 of them militias, a 244% jump. So if you worry about political violence, the SPLC said, such growth is cause for grave concern. The implication is that the Hutteri are just the tip of the iceberg and that the heartland is filled with these terror conspiracies. Last month, the organization came out with another report claiming that the number of right-wing patriot groups had grown by more than 60% in the year 2010. Now, there's a few problems with these numbers. I'm not going to get into all of them. It's worth pointing out that if a group has a big faction fight and splits in two, that shows up as growth, although it actually indicates that the group's getting weaker. But I'm going to stipulate that there has been a general increase in right-wing activism since the Democrat became president, and that's going to show up on the far right as well. But the Hutteri haven't had their trial yet. I'm not going to get into the case of how strong, into the issue of how strong the case against them is or is not. But for the sake of the argument, let's assume the worst-case scenario, that the defendants really were planning a massacre and that they really were capable of carrying it out. They still wouldn't be the vanguard of the right-wing revolution because the Hutteri are isolated and despised not just by the American mainstream but by the bulk of the groups on the Patriot list, the SPLC's list of Patriot organizations. And indeed, the government may have had the help of some anti-Hutteri militiamen as it forged its case against the accused. The SPLC list, it keeps getting touted in Newsweek and all these other outlets. It lumps together a very diverse set of organizations, blurring the boundary between people who might have sympathy for that style of plot that the Hutteri are accused of, and people who would want no part of them. If you wonder how the SPLC decides who goes on this list of organizations that's been floating, generally, the groups on its roster define themselves as opposed to the New World Order, or New World Order, engage in groundless conspiracy theorizing, or advocate or adhere to extreme anti-government doctrines. That covers a lot of ground. Using this list to track the threat of right-wing terrorism, it's like tracking the threat of Islamist terrorism by counting the country's mosques. Now, we were about to have some hearings in Washington by someone who I think would try to do that. I think most people know better. The SPLC does acknowledge that not all the groups on its list advocate or engage in violence or other criminal activities. That's, again, a quote from them. But its spokespeople regularly suggest that there's a slippery slope at work. Mark Kotok from the SPLC has told the Las Vegas Review-Journal that he wouldn't accuse any member of the Oath Keepers, a group whose chapters take up dozens of spots on the watch list, of being Timothy McVeigh. But the organization is spreading paranoia, he continued, and, quote, these kinds of conspiracy theories are what drive a small number of people to criminal violence. So that's a variation on the old gateway drug argument, where the fact that people who abuse heroin are likely to have tried pot first is seen as evidence that pot causes heroin abuse. Kotok is also understating the different directions that people in these patriot movement circles can be pulled. The Oath Keepers, which he cited, have distanced themselves from violent-minded supporters. And indeed, the whole point of the organization is to persuade the government's agents to refuse order the group considers unconstitutional, which is not a tactic of terrorism, it's a tactic of nonviolent civil disobedience, which he will, I mean, we have just did an interview with him that appeared on the website, it's about to appear in the magazine, in which he specifically cites things like the Tunisian and Egyptian military refusing to fire on protesters as what he is trying to organize in the military. Meanwhile, 41 groups on the SPLC's 2009 list are chapters of the John Birch Society. Far from being an adjunct to the militias, the Birchers, who are notorious for their own wild conspiracy theories, devote a lot of effort to debunking the even more elaborate conspiracy yarns that are popular in the militia world, and particularly among groups like the Hutteri. And the Birchers also frowned on insurrectionary violence, and they sometimes suggest that it merely plays into the hands of the grand cabal. That's their variety of conspiracy theory generally holds that, you know, the New World Order types would love to see violence break out between the far left and the far right. So if you're on the far right and you're calling for taking up guns against the man, then you're being a tool of the man. So the militia subculture itself is far from united. The University of Hartford historian Robert Churchill who wrote a very good book on the subject called To Shake Their Guns in the Tyrant's Face, has identified two distinct, though sometimes overlapping, elements within the movement, the constitutionalists and the millenarians. The constitutionalists stress civil liberties, organizing the public. The millenarians is more prone to paranoid, violent, apocalyptic rhetoric, and is more likely to form secret cells. And there doesn't seem to be any love lost between those folks, the Huttery at the far end of the millenarian side of the spectrum, and the area's dominant militia, which is the constitutionalist Southeast Michigan Volunteer Militia, and which greeted the Huttery arrest by denouncing the group as a religious cult. Mike Lackamar of the Southeast Michigan Volunteer Militia even told the Detroit News that the Huttery had called his militia asking for assistance during the raids and had been rebuffed. And both Lackamar and Lee Miracle, who is a member of yet another militia in the area, the Southeast Michigan Militia, told the Detroit News that they had warned the FBI about the Huttery over a year before the arrests. And that Miracle says he urged the agency to check out the Huttery website, telling his contact, "See if they creep you out the way they creep me out." And last they checked, the FBI would neither confirm nor deny these claims. But Amy Cooter, who's right here in the audience, a doctoral candidate in sociology here at the University of Michigan, has been doing field work in the state's militia movement for 2 years now. She reports that she's seen emails about the Huttery that militia members sent to the FBI, and she's corroborated a lot of these other claims by militia members as well. You can expand on that if you'd like.
It's actually 3 years now at this point that I've been in field, but officially as of this month. But yeah, I've seen firsthand some of the emails that went to the FBI on this matter, and her got a phone call the night that it first went down, sort of just letting me know what was going on too. And it's true to say that there's a sharp divide between the Huttery here and most of the militias that are active in the state.
And again, this is an example of the way the dots are connected in this paranoid fashion. The militias serve as sort of an other, in the same way that someone on the right might see illegal immigrants or whoever, depending on what corner of the right they come from, as an other. And it's easy to then start believing, first of all, that all sorts of evil things are brewing, but also that there are greater organizational connections, conspiracies, if you will, among them. And when people talk about political paranoia, the first phrase that jumps to mind is probably conspiracy theory. That's a little misleading for two reasons. The first is that many conspiracies really do exist in the real world, and it's not paranoid to talk about them. You know, the CIA really did try to assassinate Castro. The plumbers really broke into the Watergate Hotel. Reagan officials really did sell arms secretly to Iran and funnel the profits to the Contras in Nicaragua. Even as you're sitting here listening to me, someone somewhere is trying to bribe a politician. So there are conspiracies in the real world. Second of all, not every form of paranoia actually involves a conspiracy. As with the moral panic over Four Loko, it can take the form of a general free-floating dread that isn't attached to any alleged cabal, though over time it often starts to give form to conspiracy theories. If the Four Loko thing had been drawn out, it wouldn't be long before we were hearing about, the sort of conspiracy theorizing that, attached themselves to the so-called whiskey ring during the Progressive Era, some of the stuff that's attached to the tobacco companies. Not that I want to defend them, but, some of the theories about them have been kind of goofy. But the Paranoid Center does believe in full-fledged conspiracy theories, too. When federal police confronted the Branch Davidians in Waco back in 1993, the media spread stories of sexual depravity, weird rituals, a plot against the outside world, the same kind of fables the medieval authorities told about Jews and heretics, and which had attached themselves again and again to small, new, and unusual religious movements in U.S. history. And this is not unusual. We're used to thinking of political paranoia as a feature of the fringe, but actually it's been present across the ideological spectrum and has been for all of American history. Richard Hofstadter wrote a famous essay called The Paranoid Style in American Politics, and I think it's only a slight exaggeration to say that the paranoid style is American politics. And that is not Hofstadter's view. He wrote that American political paranoia has been the preferred style only of minority movements. That's quote again, but he's wrong about that. And we'll take a quick tour through some of the biggest conflicts in U.S. history and see what we find. And while we're looking at these, you might want to think about it's really true that political rhetoric was fiercer only, and fiercer now than it was in earlier paragraphs. And the ideological origins of the American Revolution, like the great classics of U.S. history, Bernard Balin showed, among other things, that the worldview of the patriots who would soon revolt against England included a strong belief, in the words of one colonist, that a deep-laid and desperate plan of imperial despotism has been laid and partly executed for the extinction of all civil liberty. At the same time, Balin notes, the British administrators were as convinced as were the leaders of the revolutionary movements that they were themselves the victims of conspiratorial designs. Colonial governors such as Thomas Hutchinson of Massachusetts, a man that the future President John Adams accused of junto conspiracy, believed, this is Hutchinson, and Balin believed in Balin's words, that the root of all the trouble in the colonies was the maneuvering of a secret power-hungry cabal that professed loyalty to England while assiduously working to destroy the bonds of authority. After independence was won, the patriots soon began sniffing out plots in their own ranks. Federalists thought that Jeffersonians were Jacobin pawns of the Bavarian Illuminati. And if you didn't think that, you probably were fretting that the Federalists were plotting to reinstall a monarchy. Nor did the hunt for conspiracies end with the death of the revolutionary generation. The lead-up to the Civil War can be seen as a clash between two conspiracy theories, one featuring a fearsome network of abolitionists organizing slave revolts, and on the other side, the hungry slave power, always spelled with a capital S and a capital P, which had all sorts of designs attributed to it among opponents of the South. A year after the war, the Northern writer John Smith Dye published a book alleging that not just Lincoln, but Presidents William Henry Harrison and James Buchanan had been the victims of Southern assassination plots. The story is strikingly similar to such post-Watergate Hollywood thrillers as The Parallax View and Winter Kills. So if you're a fan of 1970s conspiracy movies, that genre is actually about over 100 years older than you might have thought. At the end of the 19th century, you get the Populist Party, which features very central role in Richard Hofstadter's essay. As Hofstadter writes, the populist movement was brimming over with fears of, in Hofstadter's words, a great conspiracy of international bankers. What he doesn't mention is that the elites of the era frequently perceived populism itself as a product of a conspiracy, a paranoid position that they sometimes salted with nativist fears. Henry Cabot Lodge wrote that the William Jennings Bryan campaign in 1896 was a well-drawn and carefully thought-out scheme based on socialistic and anarchistic theories imported from Europe. Kansas Republicans attacked the publishers of a populist paper as a secret band of conspirators. In the 20th century, we've had a series of Red Scares and Brown Scares. I assume you all know what a Red Scare is. A Brown Scare is sort of the opposite. It's named after the brown shirts of fascism. The historian Leo Rabuffo coined the term Brown Scare to describe a moment in the 1930s and 40s when an understandable fear of Nazis unleashed some much less defensible calls for, in Rabuffo's words, restrictions on the right of right-wing agitators to speak, publish, and assemble. In the process, the authorities conflated some very different people together, leading to surveillance not just of German sympathizers, but of reputable conservatives. Other historians have identified two subsequent Brown Scares, one in the early 60s and one in the 90s. That's sort of the militia panic that some of you might actually recall from living memory. Both Red Scares and Brown Scares exaggerate the threats at hand and obscure the distinctions between genuinely violent plotters, radical but peaceful activists, and members of the mainstream. And you can see that same mindset at work in press accounts that blur so many boundaries that there seems to be little difference between a terror cell and a Tea Party rally. The mainstream goes through all sorts of spasms of paranoia periodically, fueled not just by fears of the far right or the far left, but by a host of other exaggerated social threats, from street gangs to LSD. Four Loko is another example. Some of these panics dissolve quick. Some interesting thing about the LSD, the big flurry of stories about LSD in the mid-60s, which obviously LSD has risks, but these stories, first of all, they invented new risks. You know, it wasn't enough to talk about what the possible problems of taking LSD were. You had this tales being with urban legends, like the guy who stared and tried to talk with the sun and went blind, the person who tried to fly and jumped off a ledge, which were eventually debunked but were treated seriously in the press. And also, what's really interesting is that these actually took off in the press at a time when LSD use, as far as we can tell from your arrest data and so on, was declining. I mean, not arrest data, the data, the sales data, because it was still legal, was in a decline. The press attention was not actually mapping on what was happening at the ground level, but this paranoid narrative was there for it to be plugged into. So at any rate, some of these panics dissolve quickly, leaving no institutional legacy, but others are frozen into law even if the initial fears that inspired them quickly fade. Even minor panics can have a legal imprint. There was a little frenzy in the late 80s over freeway shootings, whose most lasting imprint on pop culture would be a joke in the Steve Martin movie, L.A. Story, but it also left a mark on the legal code in California. The panic faded after this small handful of unrelated incidents turned out not to be an emerging threat, trend, and there was no Mad Max bloodshed on the highways of California, but California still passed 3 freeway violence bills to deal with the alleged threat. So do we have reason to believe that something like that is going to happen this time? Maybe, maybe not. There are some terrible proposals floating around, but that's different from actual laws being passed. The good news is that Barack Obama has generally refrained from stoking the flames the way some of his predecessors did. Bill Clinton, for example, used the aftermath of Oklahoma City bombing to pass the Anti-Terrorism Act in 1996, much as the Bush administration used 9/11 to push through the Patriot Act. More broadly, after the Oklahoma City bombing inspired a general fear of militias, even after it became clear that there was no evidence that Timothy McVeigh or the Nichols brothers had been involved in a militia, Clinton used that fear to improve his political standing. Dick Morris, who was working for Clinton at the time, was when he was a sleazy Clinton advisor instead of a sleazy Clinton critic. He wrote a memo that included a section called How to Use Extremism as Issue Against Republicans. He basically urged the president to introduce intrusive, that's Morris's word, intrusive measures against the far right, which would then, quoting his memo, provoke outrage by extremist groups who will write their local Republican congressmen. He hoped that would bait the congressman into complaining and thus link the right wing of the party to extremist groups. Now, some of Obama's supporters have repeated Clinton's 90s rhetoric recently. Bill Clinton himself has done a little bit of that. But Obama's speech after the Tucson shootings avoided that sort of argument, and he hasn't pushed for any sweeping bills like the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act or like the Patriot Act in 2001. But unfortunately, the federal government has gotten pretty good at expanding even without new legislative assistance. And here I want to make a point about the current panic about rising right-wing violence that a lot of people don't appreciate, including people on the right who have been aware of it because they don't like being linked with people like Jared Lee Loughlin. There's a real sense in which the right has made its own bed here. Institutions created by Republicans during the Bush era have adapted very well to the current ground scare. It was the Department of Homeland Security, a vast new bureaucracy created after 9/11, that issued the infamous report on the threat of right-wing extremism, a phenomenon it seemed to define more by ideology than by propensity to violence. They did another report on left-wing extremism, which included such nonviolent groups as Crime Think and the Broca Society. So I don't see any sign that you have to be violent to meet the report's definition of extremist. Michael Gurman, a German, a former FBI agent who now works for the ACLU, said, and I think rightly, that the Homeland Security paper focuses on ideas rather than crime, and that's not the sort of information you want to be giving law enforcement people if you want to be preventing violence rather than surveilling people for their creepy or unusual or just weird ideas. And who was it that gave the agency that produced that report? It was Bush. When it wasn't Homeland Security that was adapting to the new era, it was these anti-terrorist fusion centers that have been springing up all over the country in the last decade. These guys attracted bad press in the Bush years for spying on Quaker peace activists and other folks like that. In Maryland, where I live, there was a big scandal among the groups that had been tagged as terrorists and were being watched for advocates of bike lanes. People opposed to the death penalty. I think Amnesty International might have got it included. But more recently, they're infamous for a dossier that the Missouri Fusion Center called the Missouri Information Analysis Center, created and distributed to police throughout the state. It conflated all sorts of libertarian and populist organizations together with domestic terrorists. The paper informed law enforcement officers that, quote, "It is not uncommon for militia members to display Constitution Party, Campaign for Liberty, or Libertarian material. These members are usually supporters of former presidential candidate Ron Paul, Chuck Baldwin, and Bob Barr." And not content with that piece of political profiling, they also warned that the Gadsden flag, which is that popular historical banner with the rattlesnake on it, and the slogan, "Don't Tread on Me," is, quote, "the most common symbol displayed by militia members and organizations." So if a highway patrolman decides that the history buff with the wrong bumper sticker is a potential terrorist and things escalate from there, you can blame an organization that was created in 2005 to fight the war on terror. This is another important aspect of American political paranoia. When the fringe embraces a demon theory, it floats around. When the establishment embraces a demon theory, it gets institutionalized. Infusion centers, red squads, and other counter-subversive bureaucracies. As one elite panic fades and another takes its place, those institutions treat the new fears as an opportunity for bureaucratic expansion and mission creep. The Red Scare that followed World War I paved the way for the Brown Scare that began before World War II, and that in turn set precedents that came back to haunt the left in the McCarthy era. Leo Rabuffo, the guy who coined the term Brown Scare, who I quoted earlier, he pointed out that among liberals and radicals, the Brown Scare prompted a reexamination of the meaning of freedom in general and a willingness to curb the liberty of native fascists in particular. So in 1938, for example, when Congress voted on rechartering the House Un-American Activities Committee, many liberals voted in its favor because they wanted to investigate fascists. That came around to bite them on the butt during the McCarthy era. The Smith Act of 1940, which would be a major tool in the red hunts of the late 40s and the 1950s, was passed with the support of liberals. Again, they wanted to go after the far right. Now, the liberals who actually cared about civil liberties spoke out against this, just as a few Ron Paul types on the right opposed the Patriot Act in 2001. During the first Brown Scare, Roger Baldwin of the ACLU reminded the left that any restrictions on freedom of speech, press, or assembly, regardless of whom they affect, lay down the precedents by which those rights are generally injured. And Baldwin was completely right about that. So my concluding thought tonight is that if you care about political freedom, you should try not to get caught up in partisan loyalties when these frenzies sweep the country. Treat them with the same skepticism that you should have in mind with any moral panic sweeping the media or Congress. It's better to look past partisanship and try to stand consistently for liberty, tolerance, and keeping a level head when other people panic. Thanks. I'll take questions about this, about other things, what Nick Gillespie is really like.
What about, you were speaking about the Civil War and the antebellum conspiracy theories. I mean, how does the John Brown's raid fit into that? It seems like that's actually,
there was a conspiracy, sure.
Yeah,
I mean, these things are, it's not enough to be talking about a conspiracy to be paranoid. I mean, conspiracies happen all the time, all over the place. What went beyond that is that people extrapolated beyond things like John Brown to believe that, you know, abolitionists were involved in this like vast network in the South that were hoping to instigate slave revolts all over the place. I mean, just as I'm talking about rising right-wing violence, clearly there are people out there who are on the far right and who believe ugly things and have guns and are willing to use them. There's an infamous case in the 80s, the Order, which was an anti-Semitic white nationalist group that killed a Jewish talk show host and inspired an Oliver Stone movie, but this was a real conspiracy. I'm not saying that none... In fact, what you're hearing tonight is I have a book proposal, which this is sort of half of it. The two big ideas are, number one, that what I've been saying here this evening, which is that political paranoia exists across the spectrum. It's not just a phenomenon of the fringe. The center has it too, and in general, the paranoid conspiracy theories of the center do more damage because they're in more of a position to do damage. But the flip side, the other main theme of the book, which I haven't gotten into, is that even the most absurd conspiracy theories to the extent that they catch on, we're not just talking about some lone lunatic, represent real anxieties. And they're, if you look at them as folklore, take an anthropological approach, they say something about what people are experiencing and what they fear. There's a great quote that Sam Smith, a very sharp journalist on the left, wrote not long after the whole O.J. Simpson trial, where he pointed out that the people who were saying O.J. was framed, from their point of view, everything was true except for the names, places, and dates. You know, they had had the experience of black people being framed and mistreated by the police, and they easily put O.J. into that. I mean, they were probably wrong about O.J., but it spoke to some real anxieties about real things that were happening. New World Order theories represent real fears about globalization, fears of abolitionists, you know, rising up, instigating slave revolts. Well, there were slave revolts. There were unhappy slaves, obviously. There were good reasons for slave owners to be afraid. So hopefully that answers that. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
Yes, I just think it's very interesting, your talk this evening. And I can liken some of the things to urban legends. And even there are urban legends in history. And one of the books that I read was put up by the Council of Europe. I work in the graduate library as a librarian, so I see many different types of materials. And this book explained, well, what are we going to do in Europe when we have the European Union? How are we going to mesh all of our cultures and our history? And some of our history is telling tales about other groups, true or untrue. And one of the members went and investigated an urban legend or a legend from the past and proved it was incorrect. And the president of that country said, oh, we're not going to get rid of that myth or that story because we use that. We actively use these old stories to continue to propagate conspiracies and conspiracy theories. It's very interesting.
I'm using your
terminology.
What was the, do you remember which legend in particular it was?
I choose not to say which country it is.
Right. Well, email me later.
I can tell you privately.
Okay.
Thank you.
How would you characterize this sort of political hype around built up around these different killings in context of this sort of news as entertainment trend?
Well, that reflects the tone of the stories, but I mean, if you look at what happened in the early 60s when you had a much more staid media, the Brown Scare panic of that era, you know, still took off. In many ways, actually, it was harder because of the nature of the media at that time, for countervailing voices to appear. I was criticizing Hofstetter. One thing, I'm free associating here, but one thing I really liked about his essay, which does have a number of valuable insights in addition to the stuff I disagree with, is he talked about the ways that projection feeds into conspiracy theories. And he talked specifically about the ways that the John Birch Society in the 50s and early 60s wound up mimicking the structure and organization of what they perceived communists to organize, like they thought they needed the secrecy and so on. What Hofstetter didn't say is that if you then extend that to the people who were writing things like the paranoid, Mike Hofstetter's essay, the paranoid style in American history, there was a similar amount of level of projection towards the people on the far right. You had groups that were looking for front organizations and people's suspect associations on the far right in exactly the same manner that private blacklisting organizations had done towards the left in the 1950s. And that all managed to happen in the early 1960s, even without the whole 24-hour cycle and so on. What's really different about now is that it's, and this is just beyond these panics, but as far as conspiracy narratives in general, it's so much easier for stray signals to hit people who ordinarily wouldn't receive them. People talk about, it's now possible to have like your own cocoon and you're only getting, the websites that you want to. Well, at any rate, I can tell you, you know, I'm 40, right? Two decades ago, it was very possible, especially in a place like Ann Arbor, to choose a political perspective and just get the news you wanted that reinforced that perspective. It's much easier now to have suddenly someone popping up as a blog commenter and bringing in a new political perspective and new arguments and narratives, either good or bad or insane, and then for people to change their views over time. And one thing that's, there's been an increase, I think, in the way that these different narratives mix and match. And I mean, Loeffner, people were trying to, my article, we have a package of articles in this, the Loeffner panic, and mine is about trying to unpack, well, what was Jared Lee Loeffner's political viewpoint? And interestingly, the SPLC, their spokesman, Mark Potok, said, well, I'm pretty sure, it's pretty clear, I think that's the phrase he used, that he was being influenced by this guy, David Wynn Miller, who is this like obscure, you could say far right, he's really just far off the planet. I mean, he's this guy. Because I mean, what he was pointing to was the way Loeffner talked about grammar as a means of social control. And that this guy also talked about grammar as a means of social control. And it's entirely possible Loeffner ran into this guy's work. I mean, it's a big internet out there, you know, and you can run into all sorts of stuff while you're surfing. But, you know, I mean, he did not change his name to add punctuation marks, which, according to Wynn Miller, will keep you from having to pay taxes. He did not claim he didn't have to pay taxes. He showed up in court. He didn't use any of these guys' theories. Wynn Miller believes that there is a true, correct language, I think is the phrase, or correct language, and there's a couple of semicolons like thrown in there to, so he doesn't have to pay taxes or something. And this was, you know, whereas Loeffner talked about being able to create your own new languages. So it's pretty clear that he was, you know, not coming from that political perspective. But it is pretty clear to me, to the extent we can say anything about Loeffner, is that he was pulling signals from all sorts of different places and mixing them up. He watched this movie Zeitgeist, which is itself a mix. I mean, if you look, they have an online source guide, and if you look through it, they cite libertarians, leftists, birchers. Lyndon LaRouche shows up, you know, anti-Christian stuff, New Age. It's a big mosh pit of elements. And then Loeffner takes that and mixes it with the stuff he gets from reading Philip K. Dick books and watching movies like Waking Life and being into, you know, the lucid dreaming, or as he called it, you know, conscious dreaming, and this old belief that maybe the universe itself is an illusion. Which, by the way, Mark Potok was being interviewed on TV, and when the whole lucid dreaming thing came up, he pointed out, well, you know, David Icke is into lucid dreaming too. David Icke being the former soccer player in Britain who believes that the rulers of the world are all secretly lizard men. and he's like this sort of right-wing brain type, which is an interesting mix itself. But, you know, you can't make it's harder and harder to categorize these people on the right spectrum. And a lot of the anxiety about this, I think, is related, and I'm getting back to your question here, to the fact that as all of these different worldviews and narratives have to contend with stray signals coming in from other tribes, that includes the mainstream. In the early 60s, you could have your three big networks, Washington Post, New York Times, and pretend that this was the world, you know, and this was the way things are, and if they're missing some important stories, like maybe this war in Vietnam won't work out, you know, they're able to shut those things out much more easily than the press can today. And a lot of anxiety is, I think, related to people in the media not being able to set the agenda, seeing signals coming in from folks, be they Glenn Beck or, you know, I mean, like in the Bush era, it would be people on the left, Muslims. I mean, heaven knows there's a lot of anxiety around Muslims in this country right now. So that, I think, is the most important connection between the two. Yes?
Just we have time for one more question.
One more question. Okay. Or none.
Or none.
Does this have anything to do with the decreased amount of like investigative journalism? Like, they're not able to spend as much time and resources like digging into the stories, or they just like take some source and then spin it, or...?
I think that... the people who are sort of propagating this in the media are the sorts of people who are doing it for those first draft stories. It's like right after Columbine, you look back at all the complete nonsense that was written that was sort of based on rumors people have heard about these guys, you know, because they're talking to people who didn't really know them very well. And there's always this first wave of stories after any event that is like this. And that was the case before the decline of investigative journalism. And I also should say that, you know, there are investigative journalists who do a really good job, and there's others who get really fall in love with their narrative, and, you know, they go undercover in, you know, among the militias of the Northwest or something, and I actually have someone in mind, I won't say his name. You might do some pretty interesting work out there that, you know, maybe bends things a little bit, but is a useful resource, and then you try to extrapolate from that to these other things, and you wind up with egg on your face. So, I don't think it's good that, you know, there's declining resources for investigative journalism, but that's not where this sort of stuff is coming from, for the most part.
All right, thank you. Would you help me in thanking Mr. Walker? Well, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Christopher Deming, and I'm the Director of Campus Leadership at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, and I run our student organization called Students for a Free Economy. We've worked with the College Libertarians on campus and the Young Americans for Freedom to put this event on. We co-sponsored it with them. So for those of you in the audience, please make sure you identify who the College Libertarians and the Young Americans for Freedom are, because they did a wonderful job advertising this. They worked with a lot of local groups to make sure the word got out. I'd like to give, as a token of our appreciation for Mr. Walker coming, our t-shirt. For those of you that are familiar with the Animal House t-shirt, you know, the same one that I'm wearing now, says college, but if you look closely, the fine print says I went to college and all I got was lousy socialist propaganda. It's in a proud maize and blue, just so, you know, when he comes back to U of M, he can wear it, and no problem. So, thank you so much. Copies of this video will be available on our website, michigansfe.org, and it'll also be available to College Libertarians, Young Americans for Freedom, and also other local groups will have it. So if you're looking for it, spread it around, it will be available for free. So thank you again.